Everyone, I call this meeting of the Select Committee on Minnesota's Pandemic Response to order. Couple of things before we start. We're having this remote committee pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which we passed on March 26th. It allows for remote hearings to take place at least through January 31st, 2021. Probably we are going to have to revisit that rule. For everyone, please default to mute when you're not speaking. While you're on mute, you can hold down your space bar to become unmuted. If you're on your computer, you can unmute yourself, the bottom left portion of your screen. And the same goes with turning off and on your camera. Committee staff can mute and unmute you and may assist you. And for those who are joining us by telephone, to unmute yourself, you need to press *6. Please use the raise hand feature, members, to ask questions. It's my practice when chairing committees to allow the presenter to deliver their entire presentation and to take questions at the end of the presentation. And that is so that if the presenter was going to get to what you have a question about, that they have a chance to deliver their entire set of material before we interrupt them. Ms. Ghanani will probably be letting me know by text once you've pressed the raise hand feature. And you don't need to lower your hand. The committee staff will do that for you. I think that that is everything. And the clerk will call the roll.
Speaker Hartman.
Present.
Majority Leader Winkler.
Present.
Minority Leader Dowd. Minority Leader Dowd. Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Carlson.
Present.
Representative Garofalo.
Present.
Representative Keel.
Present.
Representative Mann.
Present.
Representative Moran.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Minority Leader Dowd. Minority Leader Dowd.
I think we can see that he is here. We're having difficulty with his audio, so we'll try to get that corrected.
Madam Speaker, all other members are present.
Quorum is present. Representative Carlson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from July 8th?
I have, and I'd like to move their approval, Madam Speaker.
Representative Carlson has reviewed the minutes and moves their approval. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The minutes are approved. So members and guests, thank you for joining us today. Today we're going to be talking about the really important issue of the disparate impact that COVID-19 has had on communities of color. COVID-19 has revealed disparities in all sorts of ways, but the impact of the disease itself is quite disparate on communities of color. And Representative Noor, I don't know if you would like to be recognized for a minute or two to discuss this issue or wait until we've heard some testimony. But Representative Noor and I had a conversation after our last select committee hearing about important topics that we should look at in this space. And Representative Noor suggested this would be one important issue for us to examine. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I will prefer to wait until the end just to hear from the professionals on the field and listen to their input. So thank you so much, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Noor. So we will first go to Dr. Dimitri Draconia. I think I'm close on the pronunciation. Please correct us. Please tell us a little bit about your area of expertise and proceed with your testimony.
Thanks. You were right on with the pronunciation, so kudos to you. So hello, my name is Dimitri Draconia. I'm a physician. I'm associate professor of internal medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases and International Medicine at the University of Minnesota. Really appreciate the chance to come and speak to you about this. So I'd like to thank the chair, the committee members, other speakers for taking the time to address the disparate impacts of COVID-19 on communities of color in Minnesota. So I'm going to speak as an infectious disease specialist. I spend my time split between clinical research and patient care. And really, I think the two key messages I'd like to sort of start out with and make sure they're out there is that, number one, the COVID-19 pandemic really is hitting people of color in the U.S. far more severely than white Americans. And number two, there is no biologic explanation for this. There's absolutely nothing that we know of biologically that can explain this. So this is all things within our control. I didn't want to make this a long slideshow, so I included a single visual. I'm going to attempt sharing screen. That may be a fool's errand, but I will give that a shot for a second, if I could. And as you can see here, so this is a really excellent review of racial ethnic disparities on COVID-19 that some colleagues down at the Mayo Clinic have authored. This is older data, but this has not changed. So as of June 2020, 22% of U.S. cases were in African Americans. This is larger than their 13% overall share of the population. Similarly, with Latinx Americans, 34% of cases are there. They only have 18% of the population. And death rates in multiple areas are similar, that they're in both of these groups, they are over two times those of white Americans. And again, there's no identifiable biologic reason to explain those differences. As for the second, so I'm a researcher. I've read a lot of articles exploring the underlying risk factors for acquiring COVID-19 and the risk factors for developing more serious manifestations. I've observed these same risk factors in clinical practice, and I can really attest to the fact that we have no biologic explanation for why people of color are impacted more severely. But what I can say from both reading on this and from interviewing patients as they come in as to what their risk factors are, the risks that lead to people becoming more infected or to worse outcomes are known, and they're risks that cluster in people who have certain disadvantaged populations. These include things like living in an area with poor quality or no medical care, having high rates of comorbidities like diabetes, high blood pressure, coronary disease, and others. A very large one, the inability to work from home. If you're a frontline worker, if you're in healthcare, if you're in transit, if you're a food service worker, you are more at risk. If you live in higher density housing, and a big one, if you have an inability to take sick leave, that not only puts you at risk, but puts your coworkers and the public at risk. So I'll just close saying that some of these are longstanding issues. They will take years to address. Others, I'm hopeful they're more amenable to more rapid action. I really respectfully urge the chair of the committee to consider ways to ensure that all Minnesotans have access to sick leave. This would be, enable them to seek care when they need it and minimize the chance for transmission in the workplace. And I will close and just say thanks for the opportunity to appear before this committee. And I really look forward to hearing what the other speakers have to say and for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Do we have any questions? I'm taking a peek to see if I can see any hands raised to ask the doctor a question at this point. And Doctor, are you able to stick with us through the hearing so if somebody had a question at the end for you?
Well, I'm looking forward to that, yes.
Okay. I see we have one right now from Representative Keel. Representative Keel.
I don't know. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Draconia, I don't know what conversation you've had. It has come to light, and I should qualify this through no expert, so I don't know that this is all factual. But I have a group of Russian immigrants that live in a they all have their own houses, but they live in kind of a rural setting, but their own little community. And it came to light that they were really having trouble. And of course, I don't think they seek medical help. That was what was told to me. And someone died in that group. And because of their burial practices, what I'm asking is, could it be the practices that created a bigger problem in that community? Or, like I said, I don't have the facts there because, my county's not going to tell me the numbers. So.
it's really hard to comment specifically on that without knowing what else, you know, I would be much more concerned, to be honest, if there was a shared funeral where they were spending time in a room breathing and talking, but absent knowing any of the details, I really wouldn't know. There are certainly some diseases where burial practices handling a body are actually quite dangerous, Ebola, but this mm-hmm. this is not such a disease. It's really hard to say beyond that.
Okay. Yeah, I just, like I said, I don't know the details. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. DeCrona. Thank you, Representative Keel. We will move to our next testifier, Dr. Beth Thielen, Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity and Assistant Professor at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Thielen.
Thank you, Speaker Hartman. So thank you for this organizing this hearing and allowing me the opportunity to speak to you today. As Speaker Hartman mentioned, I'm an assistant professor at in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases and Immunology and a member of Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity. I am a physician scientist trained in pediatric and adult infectious diseases and a researcher at the University of Minnesota studying respiratory viral infections. As a physician, I come face-to-face on a daily basis with the many ways in which social and economic factors increase the risk of infections for my patients. We've all been struggling for the past 6 months, but some of us definitely much more than others. And I hope that today will be about naming problems and brainstorming for finding solutions. I will say long before COVID-19, I could see the disparities playing out in many ways in my practice. From the high rates of life-threatening bloodstream infections among people who inject drugs, to the high rates of tuberculosis among those who are homeless or incarcerated, and the disproportionately high rates of HIV infection in gay men of color. And given these existing disparities, it was no surprise to me that COVID-19 disproportionately affected some of the most disadvantaged communities in Minnesota. And I've got some examples, some of which Dr. Draconi already touched on. So crowded housing and multi-generational living situations that limit the ability to physically distance, limited access to high quality food, living in so-called food deserts, which contribute to rates of obesity and diabetes, lack of access to safe outdoor exercise and play areas that can limit higher risk indoor exposure, employment and low wage essential jobs with limited access to personal protective equipment and paid sick leave to allow workers to stay home when they're ill and avoid spreading the infection to coworkers and customers. And I think underlying all of these is the legacy of structural racism that's been so clearly brought to the fore by the death of George Floyd. And the disparities I just described are clearly reflected in our state infection data. And I shared with you three figures, and I think you should have received those in your email and are available online. The first shows the higher rates of COVID infection, hospitalization, ICU admission, and death among Minnesotans of color. I think you should be able to look at that, and I'm happy to take questions if there's specifics about that. While the majority of the severe death and disease from COVID have been among adults, I think children have also been affected, both directly and indirectly. And the second figure that I shared highlights the higher rates of COVID infection and the unexpectedly large number of cases of multisystem inflammatory syndrome among Black children, who are 61% of our MISD cases here in Minnesota, but only 6% of the population. And in addition to the direct effects of the infection, the COVID-19 pandemic has had an enormous impact on access to childcare and education. And with many schools employing hybrid and distance learning models due to the high and rising caseloads, I think working parents are faced with really difficult choices to either forego work and income to stay home with their children or place their child in environments that do not foster their education and may in fact be unsafe. And families with financial resources may access alternative education opportunities such as private schools with smaller class sizes and higher quality facilities that have better physical distancing. But these alternatives are not accessible to low-income households who already suffer from underfunded schools. And schools provide not only education, but social and emotional support and sometimes access to regular meals. And I think in Minnesota, we have some of the largest achievement gaps by race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status, and COVID-19 threatens to exacerbate these disparities. Now, as a pediatrician, I am a firm believer in the motto, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And in pediatrics, that means access to routine well child care, including childhood immunizations. And prior to COVID-19, we were already at risk of losing these gains due to scientifically unfounded claims about vaccine safety. and the breakdown of health systems due to COVID have further threatened vaccine programs, putting our community at risk of additional disease outbreaks similar to the 2017 measles outbreak. This worrisome trend was illustrated in the third figure that shows declining rates of routine vaccination, temporally correlating with the onset of the pandemic in the United States. And to provide routine primary care, Minnesota has increasingly transitioned to telemedicine, but unfortunately not all Minnesotans have access to high-speed, reliable internet connectivity. And telemedicine can be very challenging if you don't speak English or you have limited familiarity with access to technologies. And I've just laid out many problems, but I want to end with an example of some strengths that could allow us to fight this infection more successfully. So 17% of Minnesota cases have occurred among people whose primary language is not English. And that is reflective of our population, many of whom are immigrants and refugees. And I've worked with many of these individuals as patients and as colleagues. And I've met many individuals who trained abroad as physicians and other healthcare workers through my work with New Americans Alliance for Development, which is a Minnesota-based organization that seeks to aid these folks in re-entering the healthcare workforce. Now, these individuals face many barriers, including high cost to complete required certifications and arduous training requirements that typically involve repeating a U.S. residency, and there are limited slots for foreign medical graduates. And despite all these barriers, dozens of them volunteer to participate in health programs, COVID outreach programs, many more than could be employed in current systems. And I think we need additional opportunities for Minnesotans like this to contribute their clinical skills and firsthand knowledge of language and culture in Minnesota's of Minnesota's increasingly diverse population. And in conclusion, I'd just like to say that COVID-19 is not and should not be a partisan issue, in my opinion. And we need to work together to get through this really tough time. And I hope that this conversation will facilitate the process of identifying both our challenges and our strengths and putting our collective resources together. So thank you. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. I did miss at the end of the last presentation, I believe Representative Garofalo, you had a question for Dr. Draconia. I don't know if you'd like to ask that question now.
That's okay, Madam Speaker. Don't worry about it.
All right, questions for Ms. Thielen, Dr. Thielen. I'm scanning the participant list for any raised hands, but I'm going to give a minute for the committee administrator to text me anything I might not be seeing. All right, and please feel free, members, to unmute yourself if you have a question and I'm about to go on and I don't recognize your hand. Thank you, Dr. Thielen. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we'll go to Dr. Farhaya Farah, who is an assistant professor in the public health programs at St. Mary's University of Minnesota.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Greetings, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. I'm delighted to be part of this important conversation. I am an assistant professor at St. Mary's University and teach both undergrad and graduate public health and also the director of public health programs there. Public health program is a social justice-driven program that teaches students to advocate for systemic solutions, including addressing health disparities in all communities. And I have, in the last two decades, worked as a public health practitioner predominantly with immigrant and refugee communities. And I've also done work, COVID prevention and mitigation work in the Cedar Riverside area here in Minneapolis. Today's conversation is about where we've been, where we are, and where we are heading. Clearly, the pandemic inequities that we're seeing right now, infection rates, death rates, hospitalization, testing, are no different than the disparities of prior crisis, and the two doctors who have provided testimony have actually indicated that. As a matter of fact, since 1999, when we first heard from the Surgeon General's report 20 years ago about public health disparities, I would say my profession of the public health field has done a stellar job in quantifying and measuring disparity problems through assessments after assessment, and we're well trained in doing assessment. But in my experiences, I find that we truly struggle with crafting solutions to overcome these very difficult, complex, wicked problems. After thinking about it for many, many years and also as an educator and working with my students, have you ever wondered that experience is the best teacher or necessity is the mother of invention? So it really makes perfect sense that the most affected community members by disparities are actually best positioned to provide insightful solutions. Over the years, I've worked in academics, I've worked for community-based organization, I've worked with government as a civil servant employee almost 7 years, and I've watched the power dance between community members and experts that are charged with coming up with solutions. Very complex dance, I will share. And I've seen incredible missed opportunities, mistrust, entangled bureaucracy that really slow walks the progress that we're all yearning for. Just recently, I was a member for Minneapolis COVID-19 Shared Power Advisory Committee with City of Minneapolis Health Department. We had very passionate, dedicated citizens that were out and ready to work, especially back in March, April, when the pandemic was beginning to hit our communities. They had members from most affected members, most impacted COVID members that have a history of volunteering and really giving in giving up a lot for the community with deep relationships. I really felt serving in that committee a deja vu, where there's a misalignment of the energy and the willingness to do what it takes to penetrate communities in ways government officials can't, and the bureaucracy that continues to be a stumbling block. If I'm to draw a simple and crisp picture of why minority communities, Blacks, Latino immigrants have been disproportionately impacted, I'll say it's, you know, and my colleagues have alluded to, inability to physical distance. Not all workers have ability to work from home, the economic fragility that we have seen, and also mental health. But the troubles of COVID began before COVID hit. We all know social determinants of health led to disproportionate impact of all chronic illness, diabetes, heart diseases, asthma, and others. Social determinant of health is not something new to COVID. It did give us an underlying burden of chronic diseases that puts people at risk for severe diseases. For instance, a recent cardiovascular health study that I participated in the Somali community that compared anthropometric and lab data for over 1,100 Somalis in the Twin Cities showed hypertension, diabetes, and sedentarism has more than doubled in Somali communities in the last 15 years. Hypolipidemia and obesity has increased substantially and therefore has the rates of cardiovascular diseases in the community. So clearly, to begin with, we started off with an existing burden of diseases. Therefore, risk of being exposed to this new virus were not evenly distributed across population. People already live, you know, in substandard environment associated with poverty, poor housing, food desert, unhealthy environment, limited employment opportunity. We know percent of uninsured has been rising, and this has really, really hit hard our Latino community. Inadequate investment in public health, if there's anything that we have learned from this pandemic, is how insufficiently we have invested in our public health infrastructure. Studies have shown when you take all this into factors, the differences in social positions, the income, education, occupation, race, ethnicity, immigrant status, it makes a difference in exposure susceptibility, particularly to severe COVID-19 diseases. All this led to the horrific statistics of death, hospitalization, and illnesses we have observed. So what do we do? Here's my call to action, and I'll put this call in your checklist. I've heard this from both the testimony. We need to integrate. We need to really think deeply about sick leave. And that is really the number one. Sick leave. We need to integrate affected community members into task force, and especially now, the COVID vaccine distribution and uptake plans. We need to improve and institutionalize disease data reporting, and particularly infectious diseases like COVID, who's been tested, where the cases, who's been hospitalized, who's dying. Also need to plan for COVID recovery, and we will recover, and monitor from using equity lenses moving forward. We need to increase access to healthcare, and especially Latino-speaking community, considering the anti-immigrant actions and policies. State needs to create a pandemic plan. Very clearly, this is not something we do during emergency. When all the dust settles, we need to come together, create a plan using health equity lenses by a health in all policy approach. Thank goodness COVID didn't have a fatality rate, a terrible fatality rate. It was a terrible, any fatality rate is terrible. But imagine if you had a fatality rate of 5% or 10%. You know, in this world of zoonosis, with all the climate change happening, you know, we might have other novel viruses that are worse than it is. So it's we need to sit down and think ethical and practical to solutions to this problem, especially hospitalization policies and practices, long before we're hit by such pandemic. We need to continue in communication assets. It was wonderful that investment were done with cultural communications. This is how you build trust. We need to explore community contact tracing workers, and especially from impacted areas that differ in race or ethnicity or linguistically. That is super helpful in navigating trust and cultural issues. We know we have flu vaccination disparities. And with fall and the flu season, we need to engage now. Might be a little bit too late, but we need to really pull up our socks and increase flu vaccine uptake and make sure we have enough supplies. And we really need to advocate within our own circles and communities to really prevent what they call twindemic this fall. Also, COVID vaccine development clinical trials. And I don't know how much influence you have here. We know minorities are not asked, and it's important to substantiate that vaccines are safe and effective for everyone to be part of the clinical trials. And most importantly, COVID vaccination. You cannot imagine the miscommunication and false information regarding the vaccine that is perpetuated by the naysayer in social media. We have to work with community of colors to build trust. I can't overemphasize this. The amount of mistrust spreading in social media about COVID vaccine demands an aggressive and heartening approach for us to do a better job at making sure the case for vaccination. Let me end by saying how heartened I feel for the intensive work that were done by all of us. I'd like to acknowledge all of your hard work, the legislators, the bravery and sheer determination of essential workers, our healthcare providers, our cashiers, our delivery, everybody, incredible bravery and unprecedented publication and discoveries in the scientific literature and policies, business community, saving, you know, and I'm deeply convinced that we can, we must end the disparities that we're experiencing. Thank you, and I'll take questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I especially like an action list that has bullet points on it that I can write in order. I'm very concrete sequential, so appreciate your list. Representative Winkler has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Farah, there are kind of two themes that I heard running through your testimony. One is the importance of accurate communication and getting a message out that will not only kind of push back against misinformation, but actually provide valuable new information. So, for example, I look ahead at the winter months and the flu season coming on top of COVID. And it seems to me that a critical part of our containment of COVID is making sure that people are getting flu vaccines so that we are not making the system that much more stressed and that we can kind of separate out what people might be getting. And the second kind of theme that I hear running through it is the ways in which economic hardship are making it more difficult to mount an effective public health response in the communities that you describe. And so I guess my two questions are, number one, have you seen any improvement over time from public health officials as this pandemic has gone through in the last 6 months? Have we gotten any better at it? And have we learned any lessons about how to do that better that we could continue to push on? And second, the second question is, you know, severe economic hardship is likely to make things worse. Could you identify, you know, it's like the most critical areas in which economic support from state government might be able to help address the public health crisis?
Dr. Farah.
Wow. And I'll also welcome my colleagues. Those are very deep questions. So the second question, let me answer the second question first. Clearly, there is a relationship between, lack of resources and that is pushing people to make the difficult decisions. I'm not sure how much more the government can do. There is a lot of effort, for instance, in helping communities with to overcome starvation, with the food, with the schools working, with the communities and the likes. The one area that perhaps needs the most assistance is maybe working with the business communities, and because business communities really do hire a lot of people, and it would be devastating if we see an incredible loss of employment that will significantly add. So if there's one effort that we need to do is really make sure that companies are holding their own and are not laying off people, especially now that the subsidies have dried up and perhaps the economy hasn't really picked up. It's a spiral into the bottom, but we want to prevent it hitting the bottom first. So that I will say is maybe one area of consideration, but I'm sure there are better experts out there that I can articulate this better. And the first question is I think what I heard you say is the healthcare workers, the public healthcare workers, have they learned? Yes, absolutely. They have learned a lot. It has been extremely nerve-wracking couple of months for a lot of my colleagues who work in municipal, county, or state, or health departments. And the dialogue, the health disparity is not a new thing. It's been ongoing, and the dialogue has begun a long time ago. We haven't quite figured out or wrapped around the best way to align the needs of the community with the systems that we have in places. And it really comes down to the way we were trained as public health practitioners in universities. And especially, some of the cultural issues that are perpetuating the COVID crisis. For instance, when we have funeral matters, rituals, or we have Eid festivals or faith or prayer related efforts. There's a lot of very deep cultural issues that might be preventing social distances that needs to be addressed. And that's why the community have to be on the table and have to forefront. But I have seen incredible growth with the healthcare workers in trying to understand and wrapping their head around these issues. It hasn't reached far enough to actually see to move the pendulum as far as we'd like it to do, but that will take years. Yeah.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and I just want to be a little bit clear that, as legislators, we can provide funding and we can demand certain actions from people who are doing this work. And so what I'm looking for, and I think what most of us would be looking for, is how we can use the tools we have as legislators to provide resources, but also to demand that, kind of action in these areas and to help provide some accountability. So if any of the other testifiers have kind of thoughts on these two issues, I'd love to hear them, because we don't get to do the work. We have to make sure that our job is to make sure that the others have what they need to do the work and that they're doing it well.
Dr. Draconia, Dr. Thielen. Dr. Thielen, I see you've unmuted yourself, so I will call on you.
Thank you, Speaker Hortman. So I've during my fellowship, worked closely with our Minnesota Department of Health, and so I have sort of a firsthand experience there and knowing the good work that they do. I think, as Dr. Farah has said, funding is always an issue, and these are sort of the programs that in good times don't are frequently there to get cut. But just to call out, they've had several media, calls for diverse media sort of funding, so asking for community partners to develop media in other languages. I think, going from printed material in another language is a place to start. But I think realizing that many cultures communicate in other modes, verbal communication. I have been involved in a program led by the Department of Health around vaccine uptake, particularly in our Somali American community. And that it's called Faith in Medicine. And that has involved, sending physicians like myself to mosques and sort of partnering with imams in the mosques to sort of have discussions around health topics. And I think it involves meeting people where they're at. And I think, funding for those kinds of community outreach programs is really, I think, and appreciating that it takes a while to build those relationships, to build those that trust. But I think this is a good opportunity to start now.
Representative Winkler, or Dr. Draconia.
I was just going to add one comment that may be a big ask, but I think the one wish list that all healthcare professionals have would be a unified dedicated message from all leadership, state, national, about how we all need to come together on this. I think that is, you know, all of our problems begin and end with ongoing community transmission of this virus. And if we could get a unified message out there, which I know is a big ask, that would make so many of these other things go away. I have the luxury of my brother practices medicine in another country. And I witness him living in an alternate world. His kids are going to school. Mine are at home going to school in another room here. He's going on trips. It can be done. That is really our biggest ask.
Representative Winkler.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Dracania. That is not something we are going to be able to deliver, but it's possible that November might deliver that for us.
I'm a little bit more hopeful. I mean, as people who've worked in a very partisan political environment for a long time, I have wondered what it is that could bring us together and that could put kind of the partisanship behind us. And my hope is we can find our way through to use this crisis as a way to unite people with different belief structures, different ideological orientations to come together, especially as we fight it and hopefully build back better. So we will go on, Representative Winkler.
Yeah, I'm sure I did want that it just, it's critically important that we do it. I'm aware that other places have done a much better job of getting on the same page together and finding the best, actually having one. And the public message is critically important. It's just especially challenging in the environment, the political environment that we are in 2020. And it is causing more people to get sick than otherwise need to be.
Yeah, I think you are right about that. Dr. Deborah Birx was here a week ago Sunday giving a briefing to the governor and legislative leaders. And she indicated if it would have been her first choice, we would not have had a pandemic during a presidential election. But she did not get to choose. So Representative Keel, I think, has a question. And then Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is running through my mind as we're having these conversations. So the conversation was how people are employed and what's happening in their work situation. I'm guessing we don't have anybody on this call that could talk about how employers are dealing with COVID in their own businesses and how they are handling their employees, whether they're working at home or they're working in a facility, depending on what they need to be doing as a business, but more importantly, how they protect their staff or their employees in general, because I live in a world where a lot is going to be affected by the weather now, and we don't have the choice of waiting for later to get it fixed. Now, I know that the industry that I work in has already tried to overhire so that they have replacements in a facility that's working outside as well as inside the company. So how are we doing with apartment buildings too? How are we protecting people that make those own their personal choices?
Representative Keel, I'm not sure if any of our testifiers want to address that, but Representative Noor and I, when we talked about disparities with COVID-19, we talked about both the health disparities and also the economic disparities. And we talked about whether or not we should include a conversation about the economic issues in the same conversation with the health issues. And we decided to postpone the discussion of the economic issues because there's so much here in the health disparities area. But I think, you're right to point out the issue of employers and hearing from a lot of different employers. I think we know from the governor's daily briefings and Commissioner Grove and the governor have been in close contact with the retailers and the business partnership. And I think some businesses out there have a lot of success stories to share about how they're trying to make things work for their employees. But let's definitely look at that for a future hearing. And then with regard to housing, that was not on my radar, but that is something that's definitely firmly on the radar from the testimony that the medical professionals have provided and from your questions. So let's have a further conversation about that as well.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to point out something that we should think about too. You talked about telecommunication, communication in general, getting people to understand the messages that are there and help them to make choices that are best for their families. I would also ask, when you're getting a telemedicine availability, don't our computers allow for us to translate so that I may be speaking in English, but the person that I'm talking to on telemedicine can hear it in the language that they best know? And I don't know. I'm not sure. So something to think about.
Let's ask our medical professionals, is Google Translate an issue at all? Or talk to us a little bit about how you are communicating with patients with different language capabilities. Representative or Dr. Thielen.
Thank you, Speaker Hortman. Yeah, so I do a lot of work via telemedicine and working with interpreters. And I will say, I as much as I wish that Google Translate were kind of right at that level, we're not quite there yet in terms of that level of sophistication to have the kind of complex conversations that I'm awfully often having in the office with people. We do have pretty reliable methods of doing interpretation services via video visits. So we're able to do three-way video calls and bring interpreters on the line, which is incredibly helpful. And in these days of, you know, in the hospital, we are able to get phone interpreters. I think you do lose that sort of facial nonverbal personal communication, but that sort of personal touch and that connectivity that is often very critical to the therapeutic relationship when you're having a discussion with someone about a very serious topic. But I think we do have fairly good solutions for that. I think increasing accessibility of interpreters and making that easy for busy health professionals is always always appreciated and always something we need more of.
All right, we will go to, thank you, Dr. Thielen. We will go to Representative Garofalo and then Representative Carlson, and then we'll move on to our next testifier. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. With regards to the testimony that we heard earlier from testifiers here, are there currently, before COVID-19, are there lower vaccination and rates among minority communities and low-income communities?
Is that a question directed at a particular one of our medical professionals or whoever would like to answer it?
Anyone who can answer the question authoritatively.
Dr. DeConia.
Briefly, yes. I mean, these are not static things. They change. The most profound example was a previously very high vaccination rate amongst the Somali immigrant community in Minneapolis, and unfortunately they fell victim to a lot of misinformation, several visits by disgraced former physician Andrew Wakefield. That vaccination rate plummeted and we had very large outbreaks that some of my colleagues were involved with dealing with. I think at the time it was the largest measles outbreak in the US in some decades. Dr. Thielen probably can speak to it more authoritatively. She deals with kids and I do not, but these are not static things, but in general, we, as she shared, we are seeing decreasing rates of vaccination and certainly area populations with lower health literacy and who otherwise are disadvantaged are at higher risk of that.
Representative Garofalo.
So Madam Speaker, and again, open discussion to any of the medical professionals testifying. So as legislators, we can get up and tell people, hey, if your kids missed their vaccinations earlier this year, make sure to get them in there and get caught up on vaccinations. We can tell them, hey, even if you haven't had a flu vaccine before, go out and get a flu vaccine this year. As a previous testifier mentioned, this will help alleviate stress on the healthcare system. So outside of elected officials using our platforms to tell everyone that not everything has to be Republican and Democrat, you know, vaccines are good. They help us. Please go get vaccinated. Outside of that, is there any additional things we can do to raise awareness, to help you, to get more people in now in the months of September and October to get vaccinated before it gets too cold out and these things, the cold and flu season starts?
I'm looking for a doctor who has unmuted him or herself to who would like to answer that question. Dr. Thielen.
Thank you, Speaker Hortman. I think being public about your support of vaccines really matters. You know, I think from, you know, we talked about the question of leadership, and this, I agree, this isn't a Democratic Republican issue. I mean, I think everybody getting vaccinated, showing that you're getting vaccinated, and that you believe this, I think is important. I think to some extent, you know, community outreach events where people, you know, going to, you know, communities to say, we're going to have a vaccine drive, we're going to offer flu vaccines, they're going to be, you know, adjusting the cost issue, make it really easy for people, and you know, make it a community spirited thing. We're all going to do this together. We're going to do it in a safe way where everybody's using precautions, maybe get your masks, get some hand sanitizer at the same time, you know, really make it a community, build on that community oriented spirit that I think is what we need right now.
Thank you, Dr. Thielen. Representative Garofalo. Quickly.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and then Dr. Thielen. With regards to vaccines right now, do people have to pay for a flu vaccine or a flu shot? Do they have to? I don't know the answer to that question. Do you know?
Dr. Thielen, I think she pronounces it like former Representative Thielen.
Oh, it's Thielen, not Thielen, like the wide receiver.
Totally fine. No, totally fine. I got to say, he's a better known Thielen. yes. I mean, I think the cost of vaccines is highly variable. I think some of you, my husband went to Target and, you know, they'll give him a gift card to get his flu shot. I think he actually makes money, you know, but having insurance, I think you need to have, potentially have health insurance. And if you, don't have health insurance, you know, that then you pay for the vaccine. I mean, and just like all medical care. So I think, you know, this is recognizing that this is a common good and that we as a community benefit when everyone gets vaccinated, even if they can't afford it. I think that's a piece of it. It's also the convenience. I can't tell you how many families, you know, I take care of children in the hospital in the ICU with flu. And they said, well, we're not against flu vaccine particularly. We just, you know, there's 50 bazillion things on the to-do list. We just didn't get around to it. You know, so I think making it easy for people to do the right thing is a key principle of public health. And I think we just need to figure out what the barriers are for people and make it as easy as possible to do the right thing.
So this is a really important conversation, Representative Garofalo, but we do have three more testifiers, and I want to make sure to hear their testimony, and then I think we can return to this conversation at the end. I know we have two more members with questions right now. I think we'll postpone those at the moment, make sure we get through all the testifiers, and then we'll, at the end, have some more time for questions. So at this point, I'd like to introduce Dr. Yablon, with Physicians for a National Health Program. I believe that he is an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota as well. Dr. Yablon.
Madam Chair, Representative Neuer, committee members, thank you for the privilege of addressing disparate impacts of COVID-19 on communities of color. And thank you to the previous testifiers for their very insightful comments, which I completely agree with. I'm an internal medicine and pediatric physician at a local safety net hospital with firsthand experience taking care of patients with COVID-19. That COVID-19 infections and deaths, along with collateral damage from the pandemic, are taking a far greater toll on communities of color owes to underlying socioeconomic inequalities and to structural racism, as the previous testifiers alluded to. I'm here today as a concerned citizen and as a board member of Physicians for National Health Program Minnesota, a group of healthcare providers who use our experience to tell the truth about the harm of our current healthcare system and to inspire support for single-payer healthcare. Starting in medical school and residency, I experienced the jarring juxtaposition of seeing some patients in state-of-the-art centers and others in bare-bones volunteer student-run clinics. These patients, almost all low-income, uninsured or underinsured, many non-English-speaking, disproportionately Black, Indigenous, and people of color, lack meaningful access to comprehensive healthcare because of financial barriers. People with financial barriers avoid medical care or delay care until there's an emergency. They often lack a primary care provider or any consistent and trusted touch point with the healthcare system. They do not receive age-appropriate diabetes or cancer screening, are not equipped with the necessary tools to manage their chronic health conditions. When an emergency arises, some crowdfund from family and friends to pay for medical procedures, Others are taken to collections for unpaid medical bills, file for bankruptcy, lose their housing. They suffer needless physical discomfort and mental anguish, and tens of thousands of uninsured Americans die needlessly each year, like 26-year-old Alex Smith, who died here in the Twin Cities of diabetic ketoacidosis because he could not afford his scandalously overpriced insulin. Our health insurance system is a Byzantine agglomeration of employer-based private health insurance and a patchwork individual markets and a patchwork of public safety net programs. While the Affordable Care Act led to gains, including Medicaid expansion in Minnesota, too many people fall through the cracks. A 2017 survey showed that 10% of Minnesotans lacked health insurance coverage at some point during that year. Racial and socioeconomic disparities abound. Uninsurance rates in Minnesota among Black residents are more than double those among white, non-Hispanic residents. While before the pandemic, nearly one in five American Indian and Latinx Minnesotans were uninsured. Underinsurance, household financial burden from out-of-pocket healthcare costs, despite having insurance, affects even more people. The inequitable healthcare financing system is part of a complex fabric of structural racism that leads to de facto healthcare segregation. Enter COVID-19. Our uncoordinated national response in the first several months of the pandemic was a symptom of years of underinvestment in public health infrastructure, as well as a lack of planful integrated health systems. States and hospitals were competing against each other for supplies. Patients' chronic health needs were going unmet. Nationally, more than 18 million people with risk factors for severe COVID-19 infection were estimated to be uninsured or underinsured on the eve of the pandemic. People of color and people with lower household incomes disproportionately reported that they would avoid seeking care for possible COVID illness due to cost of care. People have received bills for COVID-related medical care, despite promises to the contrary, including a constituent of Representative Noors who received an unexpected ambulance bill. 25% of white Minnesotans, 44% of indigenous Minnesotans, and more than 50% of Black Minnesotans have filed for unemployment due to pandemic economic disruption. And we know that health insurance is linked to many people's jobs. Uninsurance rates are soaring across the country. Unsheltered homelessness is surging. I humbly suggest that this committee consider a session devoted entirely to that issue. Meanwhile, private insurance companies, which excel at extracting enormous profits from the healthcare system while generating enormous administrative waste, paying for marketing, advertising, and lobbying, continue to soldier on. Minnesota-based insurance giant United Health Group posted record profits of $6.6 billion in the second quarter of 2020. Physicians for a National Health Program believes, as do most healthcare workers that I know, that access to high-quality healthcare is a right of all people and should be provided equitably as a public service rather than bought and sold as a commodity. PNHP recommends several actions to fight COVID-19. One, immediately protect patients from medical costs due to COVID-19. Two, implement universal coverage through a Medicare for All reform. Three, restore our public health infrastructure. Four, protect incarcerated patients. Five, protect immigrant patients. Six, stabilize hospital financing while protecting patients from hospital costs. Seven, ensure that pharmaceuticals and vaccines, including for COVID-19, are affordable for the public. And eight, encourage global cooperation. Guaranteeing access to comprehensive healthcare to everyone free at the point of care is prudent economically because it reduces administrative waste and enables bulk price negotiation. It is smart policy because it allows for transparent, rational health system planning. And most importantly, it is a powerful tool to promote equity because it dismantles barriers that affect so many patients and families, but that disproportionately and unfairly impact people of color. Hence, it is no surprise that it has been endorsed by grassroots groups not only devoted to healthcare, but to those seeking to end poverty and structural racism, including the Poor People's Campaign and the medical student-run group White Coats for Black Lives. Temporarily patching a system without addressing the fault lines along which it has failed will keep baking unacceptable health inequities into our society today, tomorrow, and for decades to come. We can and we must do better. If we truly prioritize, as to echo Dr. Farah, equity in all policies as a primary consideration rather than an afterthought, if we truly center the needs and voices of people experiencing or at risk of poverty and of Black, Indigenous, and Minnesotans of color, and if we also create a comprehensive, single-payer, improved and expanded Medicare for All system here in Minnesota via the Minnesota Health Plan, chief authored HF 1200 by Representative Mann, we will do better. Thank you.
Well, we refer to that as the Mann Plan in the Minnesota House. I think that there's there are groupies with signs. I'm not even sure they might have T-shirts. Thank you for your testimony. I am not sure I see questions at this point. Really, again, appreciate a bulleted list. That really helps my concrete sequential brain. So, well, if you can stick around to answer questions, we will go on to our next testifier. So just to give people a sense of direction for the hearing, we have four medical professionals. We are now going to transition to someone who's going to share a personal story, and then we're going to hear a health organization perspective as our last testifier. Our next testifier, Ms. Hawaya Farah, is a clinical specialist with TransMedics, and she is going to share a personal story with us.
Good morning. I want to thank you all, especially Representative Mohammed Noor and Representative Hadan, for highlighting our community issue at a state level. Again, my name is Hawaya. I'm a mother of a three. I'm a clinician with a vast experience in healthcare system. I'm here today because of the loss of my father through COVID and how I saw the inadequacies in our healthcare that was hard to navigate even for someone in the healthcare like myself. I want to talk about my experience and what led me to be in front of you today. I started working at University of Minnesota Medical Center as an intern at the age of 22. When I graduated from university, I was hired as a full-time respiratory therapist. My experiences throughout my career has been challenging and demanding both physically and mentally. Some of these challenges arise because of the lack of supportive system to diversity and inclusion. And as a young caregiver, I was determined to show others that I was capable and equipped with the knowledge and experience to do my job effectively. I can tell you firsthand experience of gaps in care that I have witnessed due to the lack of cultural awareness, education, and training. For the past 14 years working in the hospital, I have dealt with microaggression, harassment, racist comments from colleagues, sometimes patients and their families. Because of how I look and dress, people make assumptions about my role, asking me to remove a meal tray or empty the garbage can, not expecting someone that looks like me could be a respiratory therapist. Even when identified as a respiratory therapist, some of my patients have refused me to provide care for them. For the past 3 years, some of my patients are emboldened to voice how they truly feel about those in minority groups. I believe that healthcare is not immune to what is happening in the national politics, and both patients and employees may speak or act on basis of their political views or ignorant views. When you live in a racist society that normalizes systemic racism, you begin to internalize all the messaging that you see around you. It gets to the point where you actually may not realize, but you end up treating patients differently because of the unconscious bias. Having a diverse administrative in the healthcare field could have brought change to the culture that dismisses minority patients. Because of someone with a different world viewpoint could help create a flexible culture for patients and families to make decisions. A culture that will not deny diverse patients autonomy to make an informed decision, because healthcare providers would have welcomed and respect diversity. The growing healthcare disparities, as everybody has talked about, are indicative of the healthcare inequities that exist within systems. Healthcare organizations need to adapt a strategy and execute plan to increase accessibility and quality for minority groups. The economic inequity and the persistent healthcare disparity in our great state is a matter of life and death for many. Communities across the states are devastated by high rates of infant mortality, diabetes, suicide, chronic conditions, and now with the COVID-19. COVID-19 has unmasked the very existent institutionalized racism that impact the community of color. So I want to share with you my personal story. It's not a unique story to minority groups. Therefore, my story is just one of the hundreds of Somalis that I have talked to that have experienced the system racism in the healthcare field. My father was a 74-year-old non-smoker with no chronic condition. He was an active in the community, worked for Minneapolis Public Schools as a hall monitor guiding minority students. He got sick in April and did not make a big deal out of it. He had fever, dry cough, and thought it was common cold. He wasn't a complainer. At the time, COVID-19 was something foreign to all of us, and we were all afraid to admit anything related to it. Few days after his symptoms became unbearable, He was experiencing dyspnea and exertion. I got the call from him and I dialed 911 right away. And he was taken to University Minnesota Emergency Department. Couple hours in the emergency, he was put on a ventilator to assist him with his breathing. I called the emergency multiple times to speak with his nurse. I was told that she was busy. I got a call from the care physician who notified me that my father's breathing got worse and he was placed on the ventilator and he would be transferred to old COVID unit at Bethesda. I stayed up all night to assure that he was transferred and settled in the new hospital. On his first day, I called the unit to speak with his nurse and I was told that she was busy and would call me back. I waited 4 hours and received no phone calls from the nurse. And since it was his first day, I was worried and wanted to be informed on my dad's prognosis. I called again. Finally, the nurse was available to speak with me. And I asked her about how my dad was doing and did what anyone with my knowledge would do, ask clinical questions. And she told me not to ask questions about medical results because I did not have the knowledge to interpret or understand them. Assumptions and biases followed me. I calmly reminded her of my rights to know my father's progress and care plan as a family member, regardless of my knowledge and experience. She then said, "This is not a marathon. This is a sprint. Nothing changes with these patients, and some of them do not make it out of here. So be patient." I was taken back by her cruel comment, and then I asked her to tell me about the rules of communication and FaceTiming as a family we should expect since we're not able to be with him. With the dismissal, she said, "Call the front desk. I am new here," and hung up the phone. I came to find out that she was a traveling nurse. I was fearful for my dad's safety as he was at their mercy. So to avoid conflict, I waited until the next shift. The next shift nurse was able to tell me that my dad was requiring heavy sedation because he was fighting the ventilator. Each day he was assigned with a new nurse, and every 3 days he had a different doctor. No consistent care and inability to FaceTime him for 4 days. I texted a friend of mine who was working at the same unit, asked her if she was able to find ways for my family and I to FaceTime just to know that he was there. She said, "Yes, we have a device and you can call," and she gave me a link to join in. Each day and night, the care was not consistent. We kept getting conflicting messages from the care team depending on who was on, and it was very frustrating. I have seen over in delaying care and dismissal from the care team. Knowing and working in the critical care units in many years, I knew the quality of care he was receiving was poor. I was personally silenced and was told many times just to be the daughter and not the clinician. When I questioned the care plan and the clinical judgment, everybody just said, "Please be the daughter. Let us take care of him." How could I not apply my knowledge and expertise to my father's care? I'm a clinician who took an oath not to harm any patient. Each day, things got worse and worse for both my dad's prognosis and the mismanagement of the care. After the first week, I was told that my dad's code status to make him DNR DNI and not to let him suffer. This was unacceptable to me because I could not trust his care team as he was not receiving appropriate care. As a family, we waited for a miracle and prayed to Allah to give him a quick recovery. 2 weeks in the hospital with many fights, with a rollercoaster emotions, with no hope for his recovery, I got the call that told me that I needed to come to the hospital right away because my father was coded and being resuscitated as they were talking to me. I rushed to his bedside. When I got there, he was receiving breath through an ambu bag with a high PEEP, which was impeding his cardiac output and making him hypotensive. He was started on 3 pressors. As soon as I saw what was happening, I asked them to stop and place him back on the ventilator. I asked if I could adjust his ventilator settings to make him more comfortable. After they placed him back on the ventilator, I made the adjustment. His vital signs became normal. I stayed with him for 4 hours before I was told to leave. The next day, the doctor called me to tell me there was nothing else they could do for my father, and there was no hope in recovery. Therefore, we should let him die in peace. I consulted with my family, and having the experience of knowing what patients deal with in critical care, we decided to not let my dad suffer anymore. We decided to withdraw some of the support slowly, and I was able to be at his bedside holding his hand. I requested the care team if I could have an imam to read the Quran for my father, as it is a ritual for our religion. I was told only chaplain was available and not an imam. I had some speakers in my car, so I used the speaker and used the computer in the room to read the Quran on YouTube. Knowing that my father, what my father was going through,
Could I take the time that you need?
I reached out to the community representatives to shed a light on what was these injustices and inequality that was taking place in our neighborhood hospitals. I wanted to honor my father and do something about the lack of the appropriate care we received from the hospital. So, I decided to join a group, form a group with Somali healthcare professionals who can offer advocacy for Somali families for their loved ones in the hospital. We worked with multiple families across various hospitals in two cities. We give them advice, knowledge that would put them to speed on what the expectations and demand would be appropriate care to give them the best care for their loved one. Data has shown there have been increased evidence that Black and other ethnic groups are being disproportionately affected by COVID-19 and dying at higher rates than white Americans. I feel most of the Twin City hospitals do not mirror the community they serve, from providers and those in leadership role. Due to the lack of viable and visible leaders from diverse backgrounds, I feel the minimum progress is being made to create vibrant community that truly understand the value of diversity. I'm sorry, I'm going to end it there.
I want to thank you so much for telling us your family story, and so sorry for what you went through. I think it, as painful as it is for you to tell the story, it's important for us to hear it and to know the path that your family traveled. I am not certain at this moment. I think it would be best maybe if we go to our last testifier and then we return to an opportunity for people to ask questions of Ms. Farah and the other testifiers. So again, thank you very, very much for your testimony, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Next, I would like to go to Ms. Stella Whitney West. She is the Chief Executive Officer at North Point Health and Wellness Center.
Good morning. Whoops, a lot of feedback. Okay, good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to say to my fellow testifiers, thank you so much. I agree and concur with all of the information that you have shared. To Ms. Farah, my heart breaks for you as a healthcare provider of color and for your family. I think it's important to note that Ms. Farah's experience is not an isolated incident. And so that this committee understands that this continues to be the experiences of many, not only professionals in the healthcare industry of color, but also for the communities and the people that we serve. So thank you, Ms. Farah, for your courage to share your family story. So I am Stella Whitney West. I am the CEO of North Point Health and Wellness Center. We are a federally qualified health center located in North Minneapolis. We have been in North Minneapolis for 52 years. We operate as a public entity health center through a partnership with Hennepin County and our community board of directors. And our board of directors, as all federally qualified health centers, is a patient majority board. And it also includes people that live and work in the community that we serve. We also have a partnership with Hennepin Healthcare Hospital and Clinics, Hennepin Health, and Hennepin County Public Health to collaboratively serve the county's residents. We not only provide comprehensive health care, medical, dental, behavioral health, but we also provide human services and social services. I want to also say that we are the largest community health center in Hennepin County, and we are the second largest in the state of Minnesota. There are 17 community health centers across the state of Minnesota. We have designed our care system on three foundational pillars: whole person integrated care, community well-being, and health equity. I want to say that there's plenty of information that has already been shared about the disparities within the communities of color. So I'm not going to go through and repeat all of that. I will say that over 90% of North Point's patients are from community of color. 50% are Black or African American, 29% are Latino, and 11% are Asian, predominantly Hmong. I would say also that in terms of our staff and providers, we pretty much reflect the patients in the communities that we serve. So what you have also heard is that the disparities that we have seen with communities of color have been repeated in the COVID-19 data. North Point began testing for COVID-19 in March, and we are part of the statewide testing as well. We provide both walk-in testing, and we also have a drive-up testing in our parking ramp. 90% of our COVID-19 positive tests have been from communities of color. Our overall positivity rate is 20% compared to 5.5% positivity rate statewide and 7.5% for Hennepin County. And looking at the cases by cities within Hennepin County, Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center have some of the highest rates and are also significantly non-white populations. So in the interest of time, I want to move to the recommendations to address racial and ethnic disparities of COVID-19. I commend your committee for looking for solutions. And so along with North Point and our partners, we offer these for your consideration. First, around testing, to continue targeted funding, community collaboration and engagement for testing communities at the highest risk for disparity outcomes. Vaccine distribution, there was a lot of discussion around that. I echoed the concern prior to COVID-19 among our patient population. We did have a high percent of our children who were being vaccinated. We, however, did see that that did drop off. One of the things that we have done, experimented with, is when we contacted our families, the concern that they had was about bringing their children into a clinic environment where they may be exposed to COVID-19. So what we did is we set up specific clinics where families could bring their children in, and it was only clinical time for children and their families so that they could receive the vaccinations. They also got dental checkups as well. We found that this is something that we're going to continue. It is imperative that our children are vaccinated. And then I think for vaccine distribution, you need to understand the historical lack of trust, institutional racism that impact communities of color. I think Minnesota should plan for vaccine distribution to address these concerns by connecting and having partnerships with trusted community organizations. We know that it matters who is the speakers, and make sure that you know who are the gatekeepers within communities, and making sure that those are the folks who are also partnering to make sure that the community understands about the importance of vaccines. Access to healthcare is another recommendation that you direct DHS to apply for a federal waiver for the continuous 12-month eligibility and medical assistance, Minnesota Care, to avoid patients not seeking care out of fear of cost because of uninsured. Telemedicine continues to be a valuable tool for healthcare access. We have seen it as a valuable tool for COVID-19. We believe that to develop and maintain access to care through all modalities. In the survey that Hennepin Healthcare did of their patients, 57% of those respondents varied in their access to internet-connected phones. Also consider establishing healthcare access hubs with equitable investment in technology and connectivity and reimbursement into communities of color. Expand the community health worker model. This is the model that we use at North Point, and ensure that the reimbursement rate is one that allows for sustainable intervention for connecting within cultural and communities of color. And then dismantling racial and cultural barriers. Address the state's social determinants of health. Heard my fellow testifiers talk about that. That is focusing on income, housing, affordable health insurance, making sure that jobs are livable wage jobs with full insurance so that employees are able to, when they are sick, they're able to take sick time and stay home. So, Madam Chair, members of the community, my fellow testifiers, I want to thank you for this opportunity to share this information. And I certainly am waiting for ongoing conversation, but more importantly, for action. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We have three members on the list with questions. Well, first, we'll go to Representative Carlson, and then Representative Moran, and then Representative Bennett. Representative Carlson.
Madam Speaker, I took my hand down. We've passed the question I had. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Moran.
Okay, let's try to get in here. So I guess for some of the doctors, is it Thielen or Jaconia? As I know, Dr. Jaconia mentioned many times over in his presentation that there's no biological reasoning why we see a disproportionate numbers of African-American versus white who have had interactions with COVID-19. And I just want to say that, right, there is no biological reason. There is a lot of institutional reasons and structural reasons, but definitely there is no biological reason. You know, if I could have Dr. Yablon do his presentation over again, I would say we just need to listen to him again in his presentation around the disparities and the solutions and how we need to move forward with that. And so when we talk about vaccines, you know, there is so much misinformation out there, but it's also a huge distrust of government. The African-American community do not trust government. And we have really good logical reasons for not trusting government. And so I'm just going to echo some of the reasons why we as a state need to form relationships and connections with nonprofits in our community. They are that trusted entity that we often look to. We trust there's relationship there. They are a better messenger of the message. And those who are a reflection of those communities need to also have those partnerships with state leaders. Those who show up is just hugely important because of the distrust with government. And so one of the things that I would wanted to ask from Dr. Thielen or Jaconia or Yablon, okay, is we talk about communities of color, we talk about immigrants, we talk about refugees a lot, especially for, you know, when we look at the Black community. Is any of that data disaggregated so we can get a better picture of those communities when we talk about African-American communities that has been impacted the most, so that that can also tell a story about how we at the state need to respond in the outreach, in the information of delivering the information and building the trust. But also, you know, talking about the structure of things about, you know, healthcare for all. We just need a system that allows people to be able to access care when they need care. But let's go back to that question. Do anyone have any data that has been disaggregated?
So I can only see on my screen at this point both Dr. Yablon and Dr. Draconia. So I can't tell if Dr. Thielen is raising her hand or...
He's still there.
There we go. Dr. Draconia, why don't you...
I will do my best to answer that, and it's a good question, and thank you for it. The issue of having sort of data that is really granular down to, you know, individual communities and the age and racial breakdown is a challenge, and I'm not aware of a good source of it. I know the Minnesota Department of Health provides age and racial breakdown, but certainly even in the literature I've read, race is not reported completely in some of the deaths and in some of the cases. So it's harder to get that data. And so I guess this is a long-winded way, and I'll just stop then and say, I don't know of a great source for it, but I agree that it is needed because even with the data we have, we see the disparities. And maybe some of my other colleagues know of a better source than I do, but this is really the domain of a highly functioning public health system, which we really need to invest in.
Any of the other doctors, just feel free to unmute yourself and say your name if you'd like to respond.
This is Brian Yablon. I will echo what Dr. Draconia said. The data are not adequately disaggregated. From my last look at the Minnesota Department of Health site, I believe that 10% of the COVID patients to date in Minnesota do not have a race identified, and 2% were other race. So I think 12% were not identified or other. And then within, for example, Black community, it's not broken down by Somali at state level. There is data presented by zip code. But I think, like, in terms of identifying all the disaggregated factors and then getting them in real time and making them actionable so you can tell a story, I think that's definitely a deficiency.
Anyone else on that issue? Dr. Thielen?
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with what my prior two colleagues have said. And I think I would say, you know, I think it's a move in a lot of our healthcare systems, and we need to push our healthcare systems to collect these kind of data. And other things, other would also add language, which is a big factor as well, I think, playing into disparities.
So I would just like to agree with that, because culture matters. Culture matters. And it's the difference between, you know, Somali and having a Quran, so we can, you know, so that matters, and having a African-American who were, like, born here in America in their practices. And so until we as a state can begin to value that and see that when we don't, we find inequities within how we deliver services, we will continue to fall short on really being specific about how we do the outreach, how we engage, and how we talk about healthcare in general and access to healthcare, because there's a cultural piece in that really do matters in our communities. And so, I do believe that the Minnesota Department of Health may have disaggregated the data a little bit more, maybe they have, but if they haven't, you know, my call would be for the Department of Health to also look at that, because I don't want us to talk about the disparities within communities of color and put that on individuals, right? It's the individual problem. if there's not structural racism or structural inequities within or systemic racism within our systems. And so the onus is not just on individuals, it is on us as a state and as a government to find and deliver services. And I would just stop there.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Bennett, I believe, was the next person with a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And this has been really interesting to listen to all these different testimonies, and I appreciate each testifier. Thank you so much. I just have a question, I guess, for any testifier who would like to chip in on this. We've heard a number of solutions presented here, and I'm always of the mind that it's good to just brainstorm and just lay so many solutions on the table so that we can pick and choose the best ones. And most of the solutions I've heard are government intervention, which I think is appropriate in a crisis, definitely. But also I'm wondering, what are there any ways government can help by getting out of the way? Sometimes I think government gets in the way, and if it gets out of the way, it can actually help. So for our presenters, is there anything you can think of where government can get out of the way to actually make things better?
Yeah, I think Dr. Farah talked about bureaucracy, and I think Democrats and Republicans alike in state government are always looking for those specific examples of where we are responsible for putting bureaucracy in the way of people getting things done effectively that we can positively impact. I see Dr. Draconia has unmuted himself. So, Dr. Draconia.
So, one small example, which would be the government has waived some of the HIPAA requirements and information security. So right now I can conduct telemedicine appointments with patients via I could do it via FaceTime, via any mobile app that is needed, whereas the HIPAA compliant secure one is terribly onerous and patients hate it. And so it's much easier at this point to just deal with it like that. And the other thing would be changing, I mean, this really gets to Dr. Yablon, is that, you know, how we bill for and code for medical payment dictates so much of what we do. Much of what I need to do is sometimes just call up the patient on a regular old telephone and talk to them and have a conversation. But you're incentivized to use technology because you are reimbursed at higher rates, and the systems, you know, are looking at their bottom line saying, we need to, you know, incentivize you to be using telehealth, when really all that's needed is a good conversation via technology that everyone has used for decades, a telephone. And if that's what does the job, that's what I want to do. And I don't really care what the reimbursement is. So getting rid of some of those barriers to how to best access care would be one thing that I would suggest.
Go ahead. So, bureaucracy really does sometimes prevent, you know, progress. A good example I can think of is a while ago, at the beginning of this, also at St. Mary's University, we have, for instance, almost 70% of my undergrad student population who are doing bachelor's of public health are actually from communities of color. And most of them are working in, you know, in nutrition services or cashier, and are really trying hard to break into the healthcare field, and they're really struggling to put their foot in the door. So with the COVID, you know, onset, there's a lot of initiatives and a lot of work that my students were interested in getting engaged and helping, and they speak almost 20 plus languages from the community, right? And mostly from the communities that have been hit hard by this problem. So what I did is I sent an email to University of Minnesota, and I said, you know, this is a very small program. You know, we don't have the large institutional capacity University of Minnesota does, but is there something we could do with our students to help give them experience? And we know the public health professional is very skewed as far as racial ethnic composition, to help them so they have something in their resume to give them skills, and more important than they have the cultural and language asset that is missing that can help really move the pendulum forward. And the response was, can we put something together, you know? And the response was, our hands are tied because of the liability associated with exposure. Therefore, there's really nothing we can do that can bring forth the ideas that we might need that I have. So that's a classic example of missed opportunity. And I'll let...
Thank you. Yes, Dr. Thielen.
Yeah, I would echo what both Dr. Jaconia and Dr. Farah had said. You know, for billing, I think it is incredibly cumbersome, and as I think things sorted themselves out with some of the remote billing for phone visits and video visits. But I think that is really something where there has not been compensation for the time on those things, and I think it's a really interesting modality and sort of working on you know, limiting, like making it so that our time is compensated equivalently for video and phone visits as in-person visits, I think will help our health systems, like allow us to invest in those things and really build those up. You know, I think getting licensed across, I have just had to go through getting licensed to see patients by video visit, to be licensed in the state of North Dakota and Iowa and Wisconsin. You know, so we're you know, at the University of Minnesota, we're a referral center for a lot of the upper Midwest for specialty pediatric care, you know, and I think some of those systems, there's a lot of bureaucracy there in practicing medicine across state lines and being able to provide consultative services regionally, which I think is a barrier. And then, you know, echoing what Dr. Farah said, you know, I work with a lot of physicians who have been trained outside the United States, and they find it hugely burdensome to get engaged in care here. You know, generally speaking, their credentials are not well recognized. They spend thousands of dollars to try to go through our STEP system and try to get credentialed and do residencies. And it's a huge amount of work to get engaged. And those are people with language skills and clinical expertise and trust in the community. They're trusted members of their communities. And I think we really need to reduce barriers for those people to get engaged in our healthcare workforce and recognize them for the valuable contributing members that they are.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. I would like to at this time acknowledge that we are 5 minutes over and give Representative Noor an opportunity to share some reflections about the important information we've heard and stories that we've heard of regarding the disparities and the impact of COVID-19. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and members. I think you've heard for yourselves the impact of COVID-19. It's about the people who are within our communities, and we know the data. We know the problems, and the time for us to stop admiring the problem and figuring out solutions. We know that it's a matter of life and death. We've known that before COVID-19. We're in COVID-19. And this means that the systemic barriers, the institutional discrimination and racism that has existed in our system reflects the results that we see. When it comes to Black, Indigenous, Hispanic, immigrant communities, the impact is significant. The economic impact is even more. We need to step up and find immediate solution and also think about the long-term solution. When we're done with COVID-19, how do we empower communities to be able to address the healthcare issues and disparities? I know we are all in this together and we will overcome this. So in the interest of time, Madam Speaker, the work ahead is waiting for us and we need actions and results soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I would like to thank all of the testifiers and the members who joined us here today. You've given us a lot to work with, and the work needs to begin right away. So thank you, and please have a great rest of your day. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.